I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Lawmakers are learning a bit more today about what Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner knew and when he knew about those big bonuses for executives at bailed out AIG. The Special Inspector General overseeing the bailout program told Congress today that he found no evidence that Geithner, then head of the New York Fed, knew about the $165 million bonuses when they were paid out last March. But the Inspector General faulted Geithner for not knowing about them. The IG's report shows that even the AIG kitchen assistant got a bonus of $7,700. Well, the news comes as the Obama administration is trying to claw back some of those bonuses and decide whether to restrict them going forward. Also today, lawmakers are talking about creating that Consumer Financial Protection Agency, but has it already been gutted? Let's get a roundup. Steve Guymon is Washington finance editor for Bloomberg News. Steve, how damning is it that Geithner did not know about those bonuses?
Robin, good to be with you. It remains to be seen how lawmakers on the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee view the report that's being delivered by the Treasury's watchdog. He basically said that the Treasury paid scant attention to the bonuses that were being paid. They didn't consider them to be a big deal. In the scope of $182 billion of government assistance, the $190 million, $165 million in retention bonuses to this one unit of AIG did not rise to the level of being a concern for the Treasury or for the Federal Reserve, which had direct oversight for what was going on at AIG. So it remains to be seen how the Congress in general views this.
Well, and AIG says that they were by contract obligated to pay out these bonuses, but they are negotiating with the government not just to perhaps give back some of the bonuses already given out, but to restrict them down the road. What's the sense of how that's faring today?
Well, that would be the popular approach that Congress would definitely support. This is the second time that bonuses, retention bonuses, paid to employees at a unit of AIG have caused a bit of a furor on Capitol Hill. You might remember in March, this first emerged as an issue for AIG, recipient of a lot of government money, $165 million to keep employees in this financial products unit. What I think adds salt to the wound, Robin, is these are the people who created the credit default swaps that created all the problems that led to AIG needing a buyout.
Yeah. Well, let's switch to the Consumer Financial Protection Agency. Joe Nocera, the columnist, writes in the New York Times that Committee Chair Barney Frank stripped the requirement that lenders must have plain vanilla provisions. These would force brokers to offer simple 30-year mortgages. And there was also a Reasonable Standard Act that would have forced bankers to make sure their clients understand what they're buying when they buy it. But the Chamber of Commerce and some banks are still dead set against this, even though some say it's really been watered down. So a couple questions. First of all, why are they against it? And is there a sense it will have any teeth?
They're against it because they don't want yet another government agency regulating the businesses that they're in. Currently, these consumer issues are handled by the various banking regulators, be it the FDIC, the Office of Comptroller of the Currency, or the Federal Reserve. The industry, the banking industry, and the Chamber of Commerce does not want the government to create yet another new bureaucracy, another agency that they feel is going to interfere, and that's their word, interfere with their business plans. At this point, Barney Frank has, as you correctly point out, introduced a different version of the Consumer Financial Protection Agency that strips out a number of the provisions that the Obama administration include and creates a wide swath of exempted businesses. If you're not basically providing financial services, you're not covered by the agency's oversight.
Well, still, this would be the first real regulation following the huge collapse. Joe Nocera concludes that even though it's been somewhat watered down, it still will be strong. What's the sense that it will pass?
This is the centerpiece of the Obama regulatory overhaul. The Congress, basically, Chris Dodd in the Senate and Barney Frank in the House say there will be a Consumer Financial Protection Agency when this process is done. To the extent that it has teeth, we'll have to wait and see how it writes its rules and regulations. But at least from the Democrats in both the House and the Senate, they're committed to passing a Consumer Financial Protection Agency this year.
Steve Guymon, Washington finance editor for Bloomberg News. Steve, thank you.
Our pleasure.
Well, Pakistan's foreign minister is in Washington for the second time in 2 weeks, seeking assurances that the new U.S. foreign aid bill won't impinge on Pakistani sovereignty. One of the requirements of the aid package is that Pakistanis take on insurgents. Well, that's not as easy as it sounds. Those insurgents range from Islamic militants looking to impose Sharia law to Punjabi fighters nurtured by Pakistan intelligence agencies to attack India to the so-called economic Taliban, fighters for hire. Maybe it's time for a little primer on who exactly is the enemy in Pakistan. Nicholas Schmidl is a fellow at the New America Foundation, author of To Live or Perish Forever, Two Tumultuous Years in Pakistan, his time living there. And he's here to give us that who's who. Nicholas, welcome.
Thanks for having me on.
You know, Americans tend to say the Taliban in this overarching, sweeping phrase, but we know that that just doesn't get at it. So tell us more about the various factions fighting in Pakistan, starting with the Taliban. Is the Taliban in Pakistan the same as in Afghanistan?
Well, that's a great question. It's a great starting off point. I was actually going to try and sort of break it down a bit chronologically, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Taliban emerged in Afghanistan, the Taliban as we conventionally understood them, in the mid-1990s, and they were led by this Mullah Omar character who continues to be considered the leader of the Taliban in Afghanistan. The Taliban were supported and were fostered and were armed and funded by Pakistani intelligence agencies. And during the time that they were ruling Afghanistan, they also opened their doors and told Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda they could be based there. After 9/11 and after the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan, the al-Qaeda and the Taliban scattered. And al-Qaeda took up residence in Pakistan's tribal areas, and some Taliban leaders did the same. Over the course of the past several years, during which al-Qaeda has been based in Pakistan longer than they were ever based in Afghanistan. And over that time, we've seen the emergence of what we call the Pakistani Taliban, and that now goes by the name Tehrik-e-Taliban Pakistan, the TTP. And so this is kind of where we are now, and this is who the Pakistani Taliban are.
And how are they the same as or different from al-Qaeda?
They are different from al-Qaeda in the sense that the Taliban are local militants fighting, as you mentioned earlier, for to sort of reimpose what the Taliban had in Afghanistan, a very strict Sharia state, whereas al-Qaeda is a foreign terrorist organization that has no home. So al-Qaeda needs the Taliban, or it needs an organization like it to be able to give it safe haven. And the Taliban, I mean, this is the key question. You know, the Taliban are fighting for more nationalistic purposes. The problem is, over the course of the past several years, there has been such close cooperation between they and al-Qaeda that what we understood as the Taliban in 2002 is very different from what we understand as the Taliban in 2009.
How so?
Because, particularly with respect to the Pakistani Taliban, their ambitions and their agenda has begun stretching beyond just the Pashtun areas of Afghanistan and Pakistan. The longer that al-Qaeda is in close cohabitation with the Taliban, we're seeing the Taliban's tactics become more severe. I mean, there were no instances of suicide bombings in Afghanistan before 2001.
Mm-hmm.
And now suicide bombings are the order of the day. Beheading rivals has become the order of the day. And in my mind, these are all results of the influence that al-Qaeda has had on the Pakistani Taliban.
Well, in fact, and we're seeing recently suicide bombings in Pakistan. Well, but let's just stay with defining the groups. There have been U.S. intelligence reports that al-Qaeda is having financial problems in part because of U.S. efforts to cut off its funding sources.
Right.
While the Taliban seems not to have those problems, it seems to have more money.
Right. Well, that's a great jumping off point. I mean, for al-Qaeda, when I talk about al-Qaeda, and I think when most people talk about al-Qaeda, they think of it being represented by, it's a mostly Arab organization with also a substantial number of Uzbeks and some Chechens. But it is, as I said, it's foreigners that are comprising al-Qaeda. Much of their fundraising is therefore coming overseas. And the U.S., and particularly there's an office in the State Department that's done a fantastic job of shutting down the foreign fighter pipelines and shutting down the resources that have been channeled to al-Qaeda for years, whereas the Taliban are using more local revenue sources. They're taxing merchants and transporters and poppy growers and everything else. So they're sort of you know, they aren't making as much for every donation, but there's a lot of donations that are coming in that are all at a very local level.
Right, it's internal. And you interacted with Taliban when you lived in Pakistan. In fact, at one point, you'd sold a car to a Pakistani. You couldn't get the money. You thought of calling the Taliban to help you because they're considered the sort of fixers.
Right, right, right. Well, you know, the Taliban's reputation in Pakistan was built largely in areas where the government's writ had collapsed and where the Taliban were coming in and saying, look, you know, we'll bring justice, we'll bring a sense of order, we'll bring a sense of government. And you know, in 2006, 2007, you know, they were considered the sort of the repo man. I mean, if you had a land dispute or you had a bad deal over a car or you had a marriage dispute, the Taliban would come in and mediate that. And I really witnessed this firsthand in October of 2007. I spent several days as a guest of the Taliban in the Swat Valley and witnessed them one afternoon conducting public punishments. And they were lashing criminals that had been involved in a kidnapping scheme. And, you know, you could sense the urging for the need for some sense of order as they were conducting these lashings, and the lashings were going down 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. You know, the 15,000 people that were present were chanting out these numbers like the final seconds of a basketball game. And, you know, you just really appreciated that this is what the people wanted. And the Taliban have since sort of taken that too far, I think.
Well, I was going to say the mythology and maybe the reality is that the Taliban were thought of as these pious, maybe rough-hewn, but pious Muslims who wanted nothing more than Sharia law. You say they were sort of Muslim Robin Hoods. But then, you know, they also murdered women who were dancers in the Swat Valley. So did opinion change?
I think it did. And I think that it really, we have to look back at the spring of 2009 when the government in February signed a deal that gave the Pakistani Taliban control of Swat and gave them, essentially said, you know, you all can impose Sharia there. Just don't take your shtick outside of the Swat Valley. And the Taliban advanced out of Swat into the neighboring district of Bunair.
It didn't work very well, that deal.
Well, you know, the thing is that it kind of, in a weird way, actually worked perfect, because what it did was it galvanized public opinion against the Taliban. The public, for the first time, could see the Taliban's true colors, which is that they did not want just a small, confined enclave, but that they had larger ambitions. So even though the deal, and I agree with you, I mean, the deal I don't think was meant to work out quite as perfect as it did, but this is the sea change in Pakistani public opinion. And suddenly the newspapers went from debating, do we fight the Taliban, don't we fight the Taliban, to how do we fight the Taliban.
Right. As you point out, the Taliban is always popular until they actually come into power. That dancer that was arrested, we spoke of, you write of how she was dragged from her home. She begs the Taliban to shoot her rather than slit her throat, and as you write, they oblige her. This has had an impact on Pakistanis, as we're going to hear. We're speaking with writer Nicholas Schmidl to get a primer on the militant groups in Pakistan that the Obama administration seems to be focusing on more and more. Nicholas spent 2 years in the region, including making trips into the most violent regions. When we come back, we'll ask him about the violence and about the duel that led to the recent spate of violence in the country. 4 attacks in 9 days, including one on the country's military headquarters. That's when we come back. Later today, a couple struggles through the recession to keep their dairy farm. Have that for you as well. Back in 1 minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to our conversation with Nick Schmidl, author of To Live or Perish Forever, 2 Tumultuous Years in Pakistan. And Nick is giving us a who's who of Pakistan militants, including the various Taliban leaders. And Nick, this past summer, a Pakistan military missile attack killed the charismatic Taliban leader Batula Masood. Afterwards, there was some calm. Then there were reports of a dramatic duel for succession, and we've recently seen a spate of violence. So what's going on?
The duel you mentioned was reported to be between two reputed successors, Hakimullah Masood and Waliur Rahman. Hakimullah has emerged as the leader of the Pakistani Taliban, but the problem that the Pakistani Taliban have now is that they are returning to their pre-Batula Masood roots as really just a collection of gangs.
Well, and I'm just thinking that this is astonishing that all of these major powers, the U.S., Pakistan, are dealing with fighters who are having duels. You know, it just says so much about the primitiveness of it. So gangs, and we understand that some are considered by the Pakistan government better than others. I mean, you have the tribal leader, is it Malvi Nazir?
Right.
Who's a darling of the Pakistani military establishment because he fights U.S. and NATO forces in Afghanistan.
That's exactly right. There are cases, actually. In the spring of 2007, there was a fascinating incident when, in South Waziristan, Mulvi Nazir, who is a Pakistani Taliban leader who points his guns to the west, to Afghanistan, and there were all of these Uzbek foreign militants that were taking up residence in his area. And there had been a major scuffle, and Nazir wanted to purge the Uzbeks out of his area, who he said they were making trouble and they were killing off tribal elders. And the Pakistani army took off their uniforms, put on local clothes, and armed the Pakistani Taliban as they were fighting against these foreign Uzbeks. So this incident really raised Mulvi Nazir to legendary status as, like you said, a friendly, good Taliban who was willing to sort of pursue Pakistan's national security interests.
Even though he's also willing to fight U.S. and NATO forces in Afghanistan.
Exactly.
So this gets to how complicated this is. But on top of this, do we also have other militant groups in Pakistan that are not Taliban, but we understand, if the price is right, are willing to fight with the Taliban?
Well, not even if the price is right, in fact. I mean, you could make the argument that the Punjabi militants, which predated the Pakistani Taliban's emergence in Pakistan. And when I say the Punjabi militants, I'm thinking of Lashkar-e-Taiba, the group that was responsible for the attacks in Mumbai last year.
Right.
I'm thinking of Jaish-e-Mohammed, the group that's been responsible for a number of attacks in India, including an attack on the parliament in December of 2001.
And aren't these groups, by the way, supported by some of Pakistan's secret agencies because they do attack Indians?
They have been, for sure.
Yeah.
For sure. And so what happened is, if we look at the point at which these groups sort of began to coalesce with the Pakistani Taliban really all dates back to the Red Mosque incident in July of 2007, in which the Pakistani army stormed this mosque in Islamabad. Hundreds of people were killed, and in the aftermath of that is when the spate of suicide bombings began. But so many of these Punjabi militant groups that were kind of not really sure what their, you know, what their sort of reason to be was in the years after 9/11. Well, all of a sudden now these groups have found that they're very welcome in Taliban camps and Al-Qaeda camps, and the cohabitation between the Pakistani Taliban, and Al-Qaeda is becoming closer and closer.
Well, is there any sense, we're reading stories about the Taliban in Afghanistan, Time magazine, for instance, saying that some 70% of Taliban fighters in Afghanistan are working for a $10 a day paycheck. Mm. 2 out of 3 can be bought off. And, you know, you read these numbers, you know, right now it's costing the U.S. $165 million a day to fight in Afghanistan. And by Time magazine's estimates, it could cost, you know, $300,000 a day if you just paid the Taliban militants. Is that transferable to Pakistan? Are Pakistan Taliban fighters also fighters that can be paid to switch sides?
I would say that applies less to the Pakistani Taliban, and that's, again, getting back to this notion of their close cooperation with Al-Qaeda. The Afghan Taliban are largely, I think you could generalize the Afghan Taliban as being, you know, as being bumpkins that have AK-47s and that you know, are just trying to sort of fight to protect their family and their tribe and their home and their village. Whereas the Pakistani Taliban, their ambitions have gotten greater. Ultimately, to gain state power in Pakistan is much more appealing than gaining state power in Afghanistan.
So what do you think happens now? There was, as you said, a brief respite in the Swat Valley over the summer, but in the last couple of weeks we've seen this incredible uptick in violence in Pakistan. Mm. We understand that the Pakistani military may be on the verge of launching a major operation in South Waziristan, where many of these groups are. Mm. But what do you think is the chance of Pakistan taking on this range of militant groups?
The Pakistani army is already stretched very thin. Part of the negotiation, or part of the discussion with the U.S. over the past several years has been trying to assure the Pakistanis that India no longer poses an existential threat and that it can take its several hundred thousand troops that are stationed permanently along the Indian border and it can reposition them in the tribal areas to fight the Pakistani Taliban and Al-Qaeda. Pakistani security establishment aren't convinced. as long as their strategic mindset remains focused that India poses the most existential threat to Pakistan, not the militants, it's going to be very difficult, I think, to achieve the objectives of eliminating the Taliban and al-Qaeda.
But you also say that the Taliban is its own worst enemy. What do you mean by that?
Well, they are a PR disaster. And as we saw in Swat, you give them enough time and enough space, and people realize that the noble idea and the noble abstraction of what the Taliban say they represent is very different from what the Taliban actually bring when they're asked to come and govern.
The myth is Robin Hood, but the reality is this harsh Sharia law.
Very much so. I mean, essentially, you give them enough time and space, and the Taliban will begin to defeat themselves in the public opinion. You take them on militarily, and you breathe life into them with every bomb, every missile, every gun.
Quite a dilemma. Nicholas Schmidl, a fellow at the New America Foundation. He's also author of To Live or Perish Forever, Two Tumultuous Years in Pakistan. Nicholas, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks for having me on, Robin.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.
This is the kind of stuff they have been trying to make sure didn't happen with me. See, all this stuff is the mainstreaming of Rush Limbaugh from off this far right-wing fringe they've tried to put me in. Here I am. I just keep tiptoeing into the mainstream, and it just irritates them. And I go, yeah.
The kind of stuff Rush Limbaugh is talking about in his Today Show interview is his attempt to buy an NFL team, world that this popular talk show host is part of a group trying to buy the St. Louis Rams, has sparked a lot of protest, especially from African-American players. Limbaugh has had supporters. Chicago Bears receiver Rashid Davis says the game is a business. If Limbaugh pays, he will play. But others cite his controversial and, they say, racist remarks. Roman Oben won a Super Bowl ring with the Tampa Bay Buccaneers during his 12-year career. Today, he helps other athletes make the transition from sports to the workforce. He contributes to the Washington Post NFL blog, The League, and is also chair of the local Democratic Party in Kinilaw, New Jersey. So, Roman, step up, make your case. Why are you against Rush Limbaugh having any ownership of an NFL team?
We know that sports in general, football, sports in general, offers diversion from religion, politics, race, and the stress of life. But when you have a guy like Rush Limbaugh, who represents a polarizing point of view, I just don't think you want that kind of a polarizing figure to be a part of NFL ownership, because NFL ownership has changed. The face of ownership is changing. It's the business group. It's the Daniel Snyder. It's not so much the family of football that owns the teams now. And you say, well, maybe this is a guy, he'll just be a point guy. I don't really think Rush Limbaugh would be a point guy if he was able to be a part ownership of the Rams. He would assert himself on some of these committees that make policies that ultimately affect NFL football players. That's the biggest fear that I think I share, and a lot of people who have emailed and texted me share the same views.
Well, is it that he's a polarizing figure or that his politics are different from yours? He just said you were the local Democratic chair, and he's obviously a Republican. So is it, you know, is that maybe a little unfair that he just has a different political point of view than you do?
Let's go back to 2003. What he said about Donovan McNabb.
This is when Rush Limbaugh was an ESPN commentator, very briefly in 2003, and he said the media overrated Philly Eagles quarterback Donovan McNabb because the media wants, and, you know, implying the liberal media, wants a black quarterback to succeed. And McNabb has said, by the way, that he wouldn't play for the Rams if Limbaugh owned the team.
If he's an owner, it would just be a matter of time before he opens up his mouth again and says something. Now, as a representative of the Rams organization and a representative of ownership as a whole in the NFL, these aren't just my views. These aren't Democratic views versus Republican views. I know a lot of people who are Republicans that don't like Rush Limbaugh. And what's he going to say next as a representative of the Rams and representative of the NFL? And I think that's the biggest fear.
Well, some of the other comments, he referred to one game as looking like the Crips and the Bloods without weapons. But let's listen to another former NFL player. This is Mercury Morris, also African-American, and not opposed to Limbaugh owning a portion of an NFL team. Here's what he told CNN.
I think the guy should be given an opportunity. You say you want to go out there and you want to own a football team. Okay, go out there and see what that actually means to own a football team.
What about that, to let him sink or swim?
We're not arguing whether or not he has a right to own a team. It's what you get with that ownership. It would just be a matter of time. It's like a walking time bomb.
Well, that may be why NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell has called Limbaugh's comments divisive. Indianapolis Colts owner Jim Irsay says he would vote against Limbaugh. It seems like the thinking may be, why would the NFL want that much attention? It's an organization that sometimes, you know, maybe wants to conduct its business not on the Rush Limbaugh show.
You also have to think about where the NFL has gone in the last, just to say, in the last 5 to 7 years, hiring minority coaches. We obviously live in a country where we've elected the first African-American president, and it's not just the fact that someone's an African-American, someone's not an African-American. It's just where the country has gone.
Former NFL player Roman Oben, now vice president of development for the Corporate Playbook and chair of the local Democratic Party in Kinnelon, New Jersey. Roman, thanks so much for weighing in on the Rush Limbaugh attempt to be part of the NFL.
Okay, Robin, no problem.
We'll be back in 30 seconds with a visit to a Massachusetts dairy farm, a family there trying to hold on to their cows and their cash as milk prices rise and fall in this roller coaster economy. That's in 30 seconds, here and now. Welcome back to Here and Now and our week-long series, Five Farms, Profiles of Farm Families Across the Country. Today, the Hagers, an extended family of dairy farmers in Coleraine, Massachusetts. Their challenge? How to survive in the short term. Despite subsidies and sometimes pricing, dairy farmers often make just a few pennies profit from a gallon of milk at the supermarket. Since 1970, on average, 15,000 of the country's dairy farms have gone out of business every year. Massachusetts has fewer than 200 dairy farms left. At the depths of the recession earlier this year, the Hagers were losing money with each milking.
And you can only do that for so long, and I really question this time around how many guys are going to stick with it. I mean, everybody that's still making milk in Massachusetts is pretty dedicated and been at it a long time and willing to ride out the storm. But on the other hand, with the whole economy looking poor, I don't know if that's going to leave it so people will stick with it longer because they know there's nothing else they can do, or whether they're just going to say, hey, things are really looking bad and bail. It's hard to tell.
That's Chip Hager. He and his wife Sherry own Hager Brothers Farm. Chip, the third generation of Hagers to farm the land on steep hills near the Vermont border. If they make it through the current crisis, the Hagers plan on a future farm that involves their kids. But to get there, they have to have outside employment. Most farm families do. So at age 52, Sherry Hager is a student at Greenfield Community College, working towards a nursing degree. Our story is produced by John Bewin and Susanna Lee.
You see, now my Spanish 101 teacher said that the only time you roll the R's is when it's a double R, like payro means but payro means dog.
Perro and perro.
Right.
Perro and
not it's pay. It's
perro.
So I'm taking anatomy and physiology too, and Spanish for nursing. I just went back to school, but there's no way that I'm going to be able to let go of the farm. I mean, I already have it in my head that, you know, I'm going to work my 12-hour shifts 3 days a week, and I'm going to farm 4 days a week. Raising six children was not a very easy thing to do. We raised our four, but we also raised my niece and nephew, so when they were in school, I have been the chairman of the Board of Registrars. I have worked alongside the town clerk as her assistant in our town. I have been a waitress. I have been a cook. I have been a substitute at our local high school. I worked pouring concrete one summer. I made cookies and donuts and sold them to get the kids bicycles 1 year. So done numerous things.
You know, there's most any job that is out there is more financially beneficial than working here on the farm. And definitely fewer hours. Our oldest son was here, left. It was a dollars and cents issue.
My older brother used to work here and decided it wasn't really for him. He's a security guard at a nuclear plant.
So he's compensated well. And his hours are not the greatest, but better than firemen. And our youngest daughter.
My younger sister really has never been into the cows, only when I dragged her.
So she's an RN, works in the intensive care unit of a local hospital.
I'm really the only one that, from the get-go, went to college for ag and decided that's what I wanted to do.
Kim is our oldest daughter, and Todd is the youngest son. Both of them are interested. Of course, Kim's husband is here. Todd's wife is a registered nurse, works in a nursing home.
Last I checked, my wife's still okay with me being here, so. Every day I get to work next to my father. I mean, you can't beat that. My sister, my brother-in-law. My mother's lunch. You can't beat that either. Can't get that in a restaurant. Everybody gets along. And we're family. We don't always get along. But 99% of the time, we're friends, not just family. So I'm not going anywhere as long as I can do it.
Family transfer is tricky business as it is, especially when you have, well, there's six of us kids, so.
I've made my feelings known right from the beginning that the farm is going to stay a unit, and anybody that's here working it, wanting it, will have it. And the kids that choose to leave the farm, I'm not going to break the farm up so they can get a bank account.
It's truly up to my parents, and we'll see how it goes. They're very committed to keeping the farm together, and my siblings are very committed to keeping the farm here and intact. They just want to see it here and running. So I think they're very open, maybe in more than other families are, because there's a real huge emotional attachment to keeping this place together for all of us.
I still got my head stuck in the sand. You know, because we're diversified, it gives us the ability to stick with it a little bit easier. The young folks are really dedicated to follow through. Oh, we're here for the long haul. I don't think so. Anything that's been mowed this year, mow.
Okay.
When you're coming down alongside the road, it's just below the telephone pole there that's partway up in the field.
Mm-hmm.
There's a dip down.
The information that's in that man's head, the farm would not function if he just left tomorrow. I don't care what anybody says, and that's nothing against Kim and Aaron or anybody else here. But, I mean, he's a walking owner's manual and reference to every single thing that's here, everything that goes on, from the business end to the animals to the machinery.
There's a rock right on the hump as it pitches over there that sticks up. You got to lift more up like the first, second time around.
Okay.
When it heads down over, it'll hit that and bust your knives every time.
Okay.
And so hopefully, before he decides to retire and move to Florida or something, I work with him enough so that I've got at least a portion of it in my head. I mean, it not only does he have his knowledge, but he's got all the knowledge that his father gave to him. And so it's a scary thought of trying to run the farm without him being here.
No, I've just decided I'm just going to live forever.
That's good with me.
Chip and Todd Hager on the Hager Brothers Farm in Coleraine, Massachusetts. Our series, Five Farms, is a production of Wesley Horner Productions and the Center for Documentary Studies at Duke University. Quick note about another family. Today, radio host Tom Joyner succeeded in getting a pardon for two great uncles who were executed in the early 1900s for the death of a Confederate veteran. At the time, more than 100 people, including a sheriff, signed a petition defending them. Today, Joyner said, this won't bring them back, but it will bring closure. This is a very good day. You're listening to Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org.
Greg Heffley is back. He's the scrawny kid with a concave chest and just a few strands of hair whose intimate thoughts are dutifully recorded in the wildly popular Diary of a Wimpy Kid series. Here's the first entry in the latest installment.
For me, summer vacation is basically a 3-month guilt trip. Just because the weather's nice, everyone expects you to be outside all day, frolicking, or whatever. And if you don't spend every second outdoors, people think there's something wrong with you. But the truth is, I've always been more of an indoor person. The way I like to spend my summer vacation is in front of the TV, playing video games, with the curtains closed and the lights turned off.
Once more, we're pulled into the life of this preteen whose moral backbone is about as thin as his cartoon stick figure in Jeff Kinney's Wimpy Kid books. The latest, the fourth installment, is called Dog Days, referring both to Greg Heffley's Summer and the new puppy who makes wet spots on his pillow. Diary of a Wimpy Kid, Dog Days, is already the best-selling book on Amazon.com ahead of that Da Vinci Code guy. And author Jeff Kinney joins us from the studios of WRNI in Providence, Rhode Island. Welcome.
Hi, Robin. Thank you so much for having me on your show.
Oh, what a delight. Anyone who got advanced copies of this book was immediately the most popular adult on Earth. For people who haven't read the books, you describe Greg Heffley.
Sure. Greg Heffley is a middle school kid. He can be a crummy friend. He could be a bad person. He can also be a good person. I think the light is just shining on him at the wrong moment in middle school. He's sort of a half-formed person. I don't think any of us would have liked to have had their lives documented in the middle school years, and that's what's happening to Greg Heffley.
Well, how would you describe his moral code?
I would say his moral code is whatever's the most convenient for him. He's a bit of a narcissist, but I think that at times you get to see glimpses of the person he's going to become.
Well, and the kid that he is will be familiar to a lot of people. He wants to tear open his birthday cards and shake all the money out. He racks up a bill at his friend's country club for little, you know, blender drinks, and so he has to get a summer job to pay for it, and he does just a really bad job of mowing lawns, and he confesses to his dad, "I'm just really trying to find out how to make money without doing anything."
Right.
Is he sort of a slacker, or is he just a kid?
I think he's just a kid. You know, I think Greg Heffley is, what I did in writing this character is I tried to remember the way it was to think like a kid and to rationalize everything. And, you know, I sort of brought out the ugliest parts of a person and maybe, you know, maybe even as an adult, my ugliest parts now and just amplified them. I think a lot of kids can read about Greg's story and see themselves in it and have a laugh at how much he acts like them or thinks like them at times.
But then also, is there something else that you're hoping they'll do? You know, maybe laugh at him, but in some way seeing in that mirror someone they really know they don't want to be?
Right. I think that, you know, the moral of the story, if there is one, is to not act like Greg. but I think that kids get that he's not a role model. It was a little bit tricky writing for this character because I knew that he could be a bit of a jerk. Somebody once said he's like Larry David as a kid, and I thought that was a pretty good analogy.
Larry David, who was on the program recently,
right,
from Curb Your Enthusiasm, and he plays kind of a likable curmudgeon.
Right. I think that Larry David is, you know, somehow he walks this tightrope of being a bit of a jerk, but you root for him anyway. So how do you pull that off? I was a little bit worried that people wouldn't like the book because how can you latch onto this character who doesn't always do the right thing? But I think Larry David's proved it on Curb Your Enthusiasm, and I'm trying to prove it in print.
Well, and you've had some critics, wildly popular sales, but then the New York Times tells us about a posting on Amazon. This person writes, "The words moron, jerk, dork, and hot girls are used in the first 5 pages," complains
right,
one reviewer. "This is a poor choice for good character building in your kids."
The adults who are writing that, and it is always, you know, only adults who write those kinds of comments, I think they're missing the joke, actually, is that all of the humor in the books comes from Greg's shortcomings. And so I think that kids know that, and I feel comfortable that kids are in on the joke.
Well, the Times also quotes child psychologists from Harvard who say, this is capturing the struggle of a child trying to figure out what it means to be a person. They could have added a good person. And I'm wondering, too, what you're saying about kids and reading. All Greg Heffley wants to do is make a tent with his blanket, keep the curtains down, watch TV. His mom says he's not reading enough. You know, there are so many millions of people at this point who credit these books with getting their kids reading.
Right, and I wish I could have set out upon that path. I wish I could claim that I set out upon that path, but I didn't. I was trying to write books for adults, actually. I wanted to write one big, fat book that was a nostalgia piece.
Well, actually, you started this online. This was on funbrain.com. At one point, you had 20 million unique readers. So you were writing sort of about nostalgia to adults. Your publisher turns it into a book for kids, but along the way, it sounds like you discovered that adults recognize their childhood in Greg.
Yes, that was one of life's great surprises when my nostalgia piece for adults became a children's series. But what I love is that the book is making its way into people's homes, and then kids and their parents are reading it. And so that's been a big treat for me to hear about that. And I was a big reader as a kid, actually, and I loved Sheryl Silverstein's books and C.S. Lewis's books, J.R.R. Tolkien's books. And so I think that, if anything, my book might end up being a gateway to more legitimate reading.
Were you influenced by Dennis the Menace when you were a kid?
I was influenced by Dennis the Menace and other comics because one thing that I really like about cartoon characters is that they never age. And there's something about the character being stuck in time that makes the reader feel that they're more accessible and that you can really have a handle on that character.
Right. It's not like you're going to get to the end of the story and there's going to be this big moral arc and Greg right. Heffley learns his lesson.
Right.
That's not going to happen.
That's part of the fun of the books, I think. The reader is expecting an adult to come in at any second and kind of set things right, but an adult never steps in. And I think that's why kids respond to it, is that they can't smell the adult behind the pen.
By the way, is Greg a wimp or a future, you know, subprime mortgage salesman?
Right. I think Greg will grow up to be a very average person. He might not describe himself as a wimp, but, you know, by calling it the wimpy kid on the cover, I was trying to send a message to kids that you're better than this kid, or at least that this kid's no better than you. Because I think a lot of times in children's literature, the protagonist is heroic, but from the outset, you know that this kid is not perfect.
I just want to touch on one other thing. You introduced class issues to Dog Days. It's again about Greg's summer vacation, which they can't have. Mom calls a family meeting, money's tight, so they can't go to the beach. What are you trying to say there about class issues or maybe even the economy?
It was fun to actually weave the current economic crisis into my books and have Greg's family be affected by it. You know, he can't go on a summer vacation, and that results in the forward momentum of the book, is that Greg's mom is trying to create this ideal summer vacation despite not having the resources that the family has had in the past. So, yes, this is kind of a shout-out to all the people who are struggling a little bit.
Yeah. Well, and you have been tremendously successful. You worked as a computer game designer. You still do. You've got these incredible books, two boys and your wife in southeastern Mass. By the way, what do the boys think?
You know, my boys really like the books. My wife reads them to them, and I worry a little bit because my six-year-old kind of absorbs the books at face value. In fact, recently, my wife asked my older son to go outside and ride bikes with her and my younger son, and my older son announced that he's more of an indoor person, which he certainly picked up from Greg Heffley. So maybe we'll put the books away for a few years until
See?
He gets that filter.
Now you know how some other parents feel.
Right, yes.
Jeff Kinney, thanks so much.
Well, thank you.